Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Thanks so much. Hi, everyone. I'm Jonathan Tepperman. I'm the managing editor of Foreign Affairs Magazine. Thank you all for joining us. With the opening of Zero Dark 30 today, Special Forces and Special Operations are very much in the news. So we figured this would be a great opportunity to have a discussion about it. And we also figured there'd be no one better to talk to about all of this than Linda Robinson. Linda, as you all probably know, is adjunct senior fellow at CFR. She's also, as of this week, a public policy scholar at the Wilson Center. And she's the author of books on the subject and numerous articles, including a piece in our November-December issue called The Future of Special Operations. Linda, I want to start off by asking you a couple questions, and then we'll open things up to everyone who's called in. Let's just start with a general question. Explain why, in your mind, Special Operations Forces have become such a prominent tool in U.S. military arsenal and in U.S. Military doctrine in the last few years?
Well, I'd say the primary reason is really the advent of what are called irregular threats, that we've really moved away from conventional warfare and into this terrain of insurgency and terrorism and so forth. And that's really what Special Operations Forces are designed to go after. But increasingly, I think there's another rationale that has pushed them to the fore and will keep them there, and that is this emphasis on small footprint and cost-effective approaches to national security threats. And they are designed to deploy and operate in very small elements. And the final thing, which we're pegging our chat today to the movie. This fusion of ops and intel has really been one of the innovations the special operators have led over the last decade, working very closely with the various elements of the intelligence community to find individual targets out in the battlefield.
So let me ask a question relating to that and pogoing off the operation depicted in the film. U.S. troops, of course, are already out of Iraq and are winding down in Afghanistan. What does that mean for the future of special operations? And are raids like the one depicted in the film that killed Osama bin Laden already a thing of the past, or will they shortly become one?
Well, my argument is that we're going to see a dramatic ramping down of this pace of raids, partly, as you note, because the big wars are winding down, and Iraq and now Afghanistan have been the arenas in which the Special Operations Forces have been operating at a very high tempo, 12 and 14 raids a night is the oft-cited up-tempo. But also, I think, and my piece really argues this is a perfect moment in the post-Bin Laden era to kind of pivot away from that extreme focus on the drones and unilateral raids to what the special ops community calls the indirect approach. And two reasons, really, for that. One is that drones and raids are, in fact, just tactics. They don't have enduring effect applied on their own. They're not going to solve the problems in a long-term way. And the second one, as I note in the piece, there's often political and diplomatic fallout from conducting these unilateral operations. And I cite what happened in Pakistan. We went into a full-blown crisis in our relations with that country. And as I think is very little known, we had a lot of civil affairs, special forces, and SEAL training and partnering efforts going on there that all came to an abrupt halt.
I want you to talk more about this this notion of indirect operations. And let me pose the question in a couple ways. First of all, tell me if I'm wrong. My impression is that your argument is not that now that we're out of Iraq and leaving Afghanistan, that there's going to be a big rollback, a cutback in the numbers and use of special operations, but that the kind of missions that they're called on to execute will be shifting. that right?
That's right. And I should note, and all of the people on the line probably are aware, there's a healthy level with the policy debate. There are proponents of continuing, you know, high-tempo kill and capture, drone unilateral raid approach. But many people in the community that I've talked to, and certainly my analysis is that there is going to be a pivot, and there ought to be a pivot away to this indirect approach of really relying much more on partnered applications of special operations capabilities. That's not to say there won't be occasions where there's considered to be a dire and imminent threat to the U.S. homeland that's going to require this approach. But there is, and certainly Admiral McRaven down at Special Ops Command in Tampa has done a lot to talk up the indirect approach. My critique in the article is that SOCOM and the Special Ops community is really hasn't optimized that part of their skill set. In very few cases have they applied it in a systematic way as part of a broader campaign to achieve that definitive and enduring effect. So I cite Colombia and the Philippines as two cases where that has occurred, but then go on to cite a number of reforms that will be needed to really apply that systematically as a new paradigm, if you will, for special ops.
Well, just so we're all on the same page, why don't you take a few minutes to paint a thumbnail sketch of what this new approach looks like? Because, of course, everyone has the Osama raid in their head, but people are less clear on what the new indirect strategy or tactics that you're discussing, what it actually looks like. And feel free to use Colombia and the Philippines as examples.
Okay, Jonathan, sure. And I appreciate that question, although I want to acknowledge there probably are some cognoscenti in our conversation, but many, many people in the public, and I think also even in the policymaking community, only view special operations as those units that go out and do the high-value target, kill, and capture, the unilateral raids. But in fact, the counterterrorism mission has been carried out by a broad array of forces. And I would say the hallmark of this thing called the indirect approach, which is a pretty horribly vague term, but the hallmark is working through partner forces. And that can range from the military forces of a country. In some cases, it's the police forces, usually high-end police forces. It can also be militias, as with the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan in the early years, in the post 9/11 days, where special operations forces partnered with them to overthrow the Taliban. That's a big mission set, partnering with indigenous forces that they either raise or go in and support. Right now in Afghanistan, there is a huge program to develop a village-based local defense forces that's just using ordinary civilians. There's also a whole gamut of civil affairs and psychological operations that go on almost always in tandem with those partner training forces. So it's not just build partner forces. It's build them and use them and influence the environment in a whole range of ways. So that's why, I mean, it doesn't really lend itself to a soundbite. So they basically have fallen back on indirect approach as a way to describe this very extensive and nuanced approach to addressing conflicts.
And this sounds to me like an outgrowth of what units like the Green Berets were created to do in the first place. Is that right?
Yes, that's really, I say, their core mission, the Special Forces. And many people I know, we've had just tremendous focus on Delta Force and SEAL Team 6, but Special Forces are actually the largest single component. They're about a third of the badged special operators, the uniformed special operators. So they are the main muscle, if you will, of the special operations community. And their entire selection and training and orientation is through with this working with partners, although it should be noted the SEALs do it too, and the SEALs have done it for a long time. They were a big part of the mission in Colombia and in the Philippines and have done partnering really throughout the world. I want to just also make a a quick note about the Colombian and Philippines examples. We can get into this more if people are interested. It involved interagency partners and programs as well. And that's, I think, the hallmark of this kind of campaign approach, is you bring in all the different agencies of the government and create an actual campaign plan that you're going to execute with the host nation in the lead. So that's kind of the model going forward for some of these other places in the world.
Great. Well, I have more questions, but I suspect that our callers will as well. So why don't I open things up to everyone who's been listening so far. Kurt, will you see if we have any questions?
Yes. At this time, we'll open the floor for questions. If you'd like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touchtone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order that they're received. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star one now. Our first question comes from Elizabeth Pond with World Policy Journal.
Hello, I'd like to ask, how in these indirect operations that you're talking about, how do you avoid just enabling bad guys to do worse things? I mean, why was it successful in Colombia and the Philippines and maybe hasn't been so successful elsewhere?
I thank you, Elizabeth. That is a great question. I spend some time in the article looking at those difficulties, because the starting point is, by definition, these countries are troubled, their governments are weak, often have poor governance, the armed forces often have problems, not just of inadequate capability, but they're also often have human rights problems. So it's really in no way, the attempt is not to portray this as an easy or quick solution, but it does hold the promise of a long-term improvement and professionalization of these countries' forces and their governments. In the case of Colombia, you know, they did have human rights problems in their army. They had a paramilitary phenomenon, unauthorized paramilitary groups. So, it was really, the country was about half under the control of the guerrillas. And over the course of the decade, it began with the Colombian government itself deciding it had to get a handle on this, so they really were, if you will, a worthy partner. They were a serious partner trying to clean up their act and push into parts of the country that just had literally been big neglected. And what the special operations piece of it was really building from the ground up a special operations brigade and going out in the field and every echelon working with them to really professionalize them. In addition, there was a junglas element. So that's just a quick snapshot of one case. But in every case, there has to be an acknowledgement of what are the weaknesses of that government and military and a real commitment on the part of that government to work on those problems.
Our next question comes from Tara Kangaroo with CNN.
Hi. Thank you for the wonderful discussion. I want to go back to the movie and the film. And in relation to the discussion, how do you think the film portrays such indirect or, at parts, direct approach? And how well does it portray what we're discussing right now? And what does it really say about such operations in a nutshell? Thank you.
Right. Thank you. Well, I should say I have spoken with the screen writer, but I haven't screened the movie itself yet. I know there have been extensive coverage, so my comments really based on what's what's been out and written about it to date. The one thing I think the movie does portray well is the collaboration between the ops and intelligence community. I do have some problem with the tactics, the emphasis on the enhanced interrogation tactics, and those tactics, I think, have been widely discredited. Witness the recent Senate Intelligence Committee report. And I think also it's worth referencing Peter Bergen's good article on CNN.com, where he said this is really a bit overplayed in the movie, the role that played in developing those leads. But overall, Zero Dark 30 emphasizes and focuses on the kill and capture element, the raiding element of special operations. It does not really acknowledge or deal with this other majority part of the community and the need to apply them as a uniform community, to apply all of their capabilities. And that's part of my problem with the public perception right now, is people literally think the only thing special ops do is go in the dead of night and kill and capture people.
Okay, thank you.
As a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key now. Our next question comes from Sandra Irwin with National Defense Magazine.
Thank you. Hi, Linda. Thanks for having this call. I wanted to follow up on your comment about one of the trends being the collaboration between special operations forces and the intelligence community. What was it like in the past? I mean, has that changed over time? And where do you see special operations forces as far as, you know, obtaining their most trusted intelligence? Do they prefer to work more with military, with CIA? Maybe can you talk a little bit about, you know, how things have changed over time?
Sure. Hi, Sandra. I think this was really the main innovation of the period in which Stan McChrystal was leading the units, the special mission units. And his, I think, innovation, and I will credit him, although there were other people, including in the Pentagon, that were really pushing bringing intelligence analysts and intelligence collectors down to the field level and having them work side by side so that they could collect a process and analyze very quickly these intelligence leads that were scooped up on the battlefield. And then linking in, of course, the explosion of SIGINT and the availability of that in real time to operators on the ground. So that was really the big leap forward, was the linkage with the intel community over the last decade. What I think the next wave is going to be is much more focus on linkage with other civilian partners to include State Department, aid, perhaps some law enforcement, but trying to get a broader approach happening there on the ground. So to some degree, that it has happened out there in Afghanistan. And I just came back from my last trip on my book research. And there's a problem right now as the drawdown's going on, because a lot of those civilians are not allowed by the embassy security officer to go out and visit the units in the field. When they were co-located on bases, that was fine. They could sit there and work side by side with them. But now a real problem has developed that a lot of them are simply prisoners of the embassy in Kabul. So that's, I think, going to be something to be worked out in this future incarnation, where it's all going to be happening based out of embassies as country teams. And they're going to have to work out the rules of the road so these civilians can get out there and see what the operators are seeing and then develop a common plan from that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 now. Our next question comes from Maya Schwader with International Business Times.
Hello, Ms. Robinson. Thanks so much for doing this. I wanted to know if you could maybe enlighten us as to where else in the world is this happening right now. You mentioned it's ongoing in Afghanistan, and you mentioned Colombia and the Philippines. Are there other places that you know of where special ops are partnering with local, you know, militias or police forces?
Yes, and you'll probably be shocked by the number, but in any given year, special operations forces are out in about 75 different countries. In some cases, they're out there for shorter terms. In some cases, it's been going on for a while, but they've been in Yemen, and this is not just to do drone strikes, but in Yemen to work with Yemeni forces. There are other parts now. Northern Africa, of course, is in the news now, and what to do about Mali, and they're talking about going in with an ECOWAS force, a multinational regional force. There are special ops folks out hunting the Lord's Resistance Army and Joseph Kony over there in East Africa. There are a lot of small footprint operations going on out of embassies around the world. I want to emphasize some of them are very short-term. They're what they call joint, combined, exchange training. And those only usually last for a few weeks. They'll go to places like Indonesia, Thailand. There are also longer-term relationships, as with Jordan and the UAE, where a very close relationship has been developed with those countries' special operations forces. And in many cases, troops from other countries, third countries, will come to the training center in Jordan or come to the UAE, and that country is actually taking the lead in partnering with them. So you've got this whole network and web growing up. But I want to emphasize the vast majority of these are non-lethal operations, which is why I think they don't get as much attention, because they're not, gee whiz, going in the dead of night and killing someone. But the premise here is this kind of work over time is going to yield, A, more intelligence, more understanding of what's going on, and a more effective approach, because that country is really taking ownership of the problem and working on solving it.
Yes, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 now.
Linda, I'll step in and ask another question. Building off the last one, really, how do you see this future of Special Operations Forces over the next few years? What are the geographic areas of concentration and growth? How will the mission change? And a third part, since we are, after all, a policy magazine, what kind of changes are you looking for from Washington to facilitate the work that Special Forces do and to concentrate the efforts on the kinds of missions that you think can be the most successful?
Thanks, Jonathan. I'll start with your last point, because I think it's very important. What first has to happen, I think, is some clarity in Washington around what the best use of its special operations forces are. And there's been, I would say, a certain infatuation with the kill-and-capture approach and the unilateral special ops that these entities can just be sent in to pick off an individual and you're going to solve the problem. But, of course, as we've seen, and even with the core al-Qaeda group, they keep replacing their operational chief, their facilitators. These networks can regenerate. So I think a light bulb really has to go on in the minds of the senior policymakers that you're not going to get to an end game just by the emphasis on an application of this approach. And I think there were some seeds of this in the Defense Strategic Guidance released last January, but it really has to be, I think, fleshed out into a real pivot in how special ops are applied. I think as far as numbers, you're going to see increasing focus on Africa, perhaps Latin America. They're going to cover down on areas other than Asia, probably, if the big pivot is for the conventional forces to focus on Asia. But we are waiting to hear really how the end game in Afghanistan is going to go, because right now about 7,000 of the deployed 12,000 SOF operators are in Afghanistan. And if there is going to be, and this really depends first and foremost on what the Karzai government decides it wants, but if there's going to be a counterterrorism mission that continues there and a security assistance mission, that is largely going to be carried out by special operations forces, plus the logistic and support personnel that they're going to need. Some of those can be contract personnel, not necessarily all uniformed people. But I think that depending on what gets hammered out here in the next few months, you could still see a very substantial number of special operations personnel in Afghanistan over the longer term, as that possibly takes on more of a Colombia or Philippines type of profile, where they are not doing the trigger pulling, they are doing the advising and assisting. And any counterterrorism missions, I believe, going forward in Afghanistan will have to be partnered. I do not think the Afghan government is going to tolerate unilateral operations on its soil.
And does the United States currently have what it needs in terms of manpower and resources to fulfill those missions?
Right now, yes, and the question, of course, is whether the defense budget, and not only that, the personnel of the conventional forces is the recruiting base for special ops, and the vast majority are recruited and selected out of those conventional forces. So as the conventional forces shrink, your recruiting pool goes down, and they may not be able to maintain the standards, and that's generally always considered the bottom line. They have to maintain standards to maintain the quality and skill level they need. Right now, the overall SOCOM numbers by the end of this fiscal year will be 66,000. That's civilian and uniformed. The badge special operators are 33,000. That number is slated to grow a bit under the current approved POM, the defense budget plan. But it could get whittled down. I think that this is about the high water mark, is my personal guess.
Ian, you were talking about personnel changes. What about personnel changes at the top? You know, obviously, Dan McChrystal and David Petraeus, two champions of these kinds of operations, are now gone. We will soon have a new defense secretary as well. Are these operators and the missions that they undertake and the doctrine that they represent well enough established that they're relatively immune to shifts in personalities at the top, or could that lead to a major change in focus and a de-emphasis on these kinds of operations?
I think there certainly is a big policy decision or juncture ahead that the defense secretary will absolutely be central in determining policy for special operations going forward as part of the broader defense strategy. The actual mission set for special operations is in law and in doctrine, and it's this very broad mission set that I've been trying to outline here for the group. What is not really dealt with yet is, are they fully capable of carrying out all of those missions? Because the lion's share of the attention and resources has gone to building up this crack, hunter-killer aspect of special ops. And it's going to require probably lower-down policy officials grappling with this. You do have in Admiral McRaven, I think, someone who's serious about trying to improve the capabilities. But there is another big element we haven't really gotten into here, and that is how much of this should SOCOM be supporting in terms of organizing, training, equipping, the so-called Title 10 responsibilities versus an operational role in actually employing these forces. And there's been a big internal battle in the last year or so within the highest levels of the military to sort out what SOCOM's role should be versus that of the geographic combatant commands. And they've kind of reached a compromise, and there's a recognition that the geographic combatant commander has to continue to have his hand on the rudder for the operational control of these missions. However, I would say there's still a lot of debate about it, and there are a lot of people that think SOCOM should have a lot more latitude. I have some questions about the wisdom of going a lot further down that road.
Thanks, Linda.
Yes, our next question comes from Elizabeth Pond with World Policy Journal.
Oh, yes, I'd like to ask about this increased collaboration between intelligence and special ops. How do you avoid corrupting, when you have this kind of thing, how do you avoid corrupting intelligence judgments by skewing analysis toward kinetic actions?
Well, you know, Elizabeth, it's an interesting and important topic, and I guess there are the analytical project is really driven from the mothership and from home. I know there was a dispute out in the field with General Petraeus having felt that a lot of the analysts were unaware of the facts on the ground as they were evolving. You know, and that's obviously was his interpretation of what was going on. But the analysts have to maintain that objectivity the same way. I mean, I think the journalists have to. They have to see what's going on the ground, but they have to remain objective. My point about the collaboration, I think, is much more down at the tactical level. What you have is a lot closer tactical collaboration. But the national level analytical judgments certainly need to be insulated from undue influence, really from any quarter, whether it's from the White House or from the military. I mean, we really do rely on the intelligence community analyses for a really objective picture or the best picture we can develop. So I hope that addresses your issue.
Yeah, thanks.
As a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. Our next question comes from Maya Schwader with International Business Times.
Hi, I just have a quick follow-up to my last question. You had mentioned that there's much less focus on like the lethal operations, so I was just curious if you could enlighten us as to what are they training these guys to do? Are they just training them to be, you know, normal police forces, or you had mentioned something about, you know, agricultural assistance to civilians. Could you give us an idea of what they're training these guys for?
Yes, and it really, the answer in a broad way is it depends, and it really depends on what that host nation government has agreed their use should be and on what the problem is that folks are trying to solve. If you don't mind, I'll go back to Colombia for a quick example. Obviously, there was a big focus on the cocaine production, the overwhelming drug industry there. So in the early days, a lot of focus was on counter-narcotics cooperation and training, in that case, of the Jungla police force, which I mentioned earlier. There was always a big State Department program on the fumigation and so forth. That special ops wasn't involved in that. But they did do a lot of training of Colombian military units that was sort of higher end but fungible military tactics. So they were making them better and more professional soldiers. And in some cases, as certainly evolved with the special operations unit, they were teaching them higher end skills to go. And in fact, the Colombian army has succeeded in really decimating the FARC leadership. That's the main guerrilla group there. And the FARC has just now entered into peace talks with the government. And I think that there's probably a pretty good prospect that the government and the FARC will reach an agreement, and that's going to end a 45-year insurgency in that country. So I guess this is really the undramatic finale of these things, if you want to look for the success point. It's that these countries who have these deeply ingrained conflicts find a way of working them out. As far as the civilian role I mentioned, that's exemplified by what's going on in Afghanistan right now at the village level. They call it village stability operations. And the special operators are focused on standing up these self-defense forces in the villages that decide they want them, but they're also working with the village elders and trying to connect that village with the district center and also trying to get the services that that district government is supposed to be providing to those villages. So it's working across the whole spectrum of governments and different development aspects. The, of course, base of the Afghan economy is agriculture. So that's why some of the agricultural expertise has been very important. Primarily that civilian expertise. What I've seen mostly the civil affairs guys providing, they will go out and do veterinary care, they will provide medical care, and they'll do assessments that will kind of help lay the groundwork for what other needs there are and then try to bring in that civilian expertise to help address those needs.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Please press star 1 to ask a question. Our next question comes from Tara Kangaroo with CNN.
Hi, thank you. And this is also my last question. I want to go back 10 or 11 years, and if this soft power model was applied in an ideal way or in ways that we are hoping to pursue it in the future, where would we be now? Where, what would be different? And how do you assess that outcome with the soft power application versus what used and where we are now? Thank you.
Well, I think that I'm going to look to the Pakistan case. And I know, I want to say, I think everybody who follows Pakistan, they know it's just an extremely troubled country. And it's going to take a long time, and it would have taken a long time regardless. But the building up of a partnership there whereby this range of special operations personnel were there, they worked their way out into this most delicate part of the country in the western areas, the Pashtun lands, and they were beginning to really make some inroads and help develop some professionalism among the Frontier Corps and Frontier Constabulary. And those are the Pashtuns who live out there, and they're the ones who are ultimately going to have to secure their area. And it's a very much of a long-term approach to the problem. But frankly, there just isn't an end game in sight if you want to continue plinking away at the, at the drone approach. The other place would be Yemen, and I've had a number of special operations leaders say to me, you know, we don't have a campaign plan for Yemen. We really need to. We've kind of thrown different things in there. The U.S. has taken different approaches. But they're not really combined in a coherent strategy. And that's another place where it's difficult, but just like Pakistan, that's a long-term problem that ain't going away. And without some kind of more deliberate approach, it's probably never going to get solved and always going to remain a hotbed for these terrorist groups.
Our next question comes from Ted Braun with the University of Southern California.
Thank you very much for your very lucid and very helpful answers to the question so far. I was wondering if you could turn your attention to the Horn of Africa and, to the extent that you're able, paint a picture of the operations that are going on there, in particular in Somalia and Sudan.
Well, I think the interesting thing about Somalia, and that's another case where obviously, the direct approach has been foremost, but most recently, the AMISOM multinational effort there, the peacekeeping or peace enforcement effort, has really managed to push the Al-Shabaab group out of its dominant position, out of the cities. And while it could be that there will be a rural insurgency, rural terrorism problem that goes on for some time, it's really improved rather dramatically from what had been, you know, decades of a very problematic situation and considered one of the main safe havens and incubators for terrorist groups. So I think that's actually turning into kind of an interesting model that people looking at Mali and looking over at the Western Africa problem set are saying, can we put together a regional peacekeeping force that special operators can work in tandem with and get after some of this? But I think what really has to happen is elaborating all of this into templates and models with roles that are clearly apportioned, and not an over-reliance on drone attacks, which I hate to be such a broken record, but I think, you know, this is really the fork in the road that Washington faces. Is it going to take a more balanced approach to these problems or not?
There are no more questions at this time.
Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground, so if we don't have any more questions from our audience, I think we can let Linda go for now. One more chance. Anybody have anything they want to ask? Okay, hearing nothing, let's wrap this up. Let me just thank all of you for calling in, and Linda for a wonderful discussion, as always.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.